Welcome to the next episode of the Beckpus Cluster Shadowboard podcast. Today we're joined by Adrian Kelby, who's the Chief Executive of the ONR. Thank you for joining us today. So just want to start off by going a little bit about what the ONR is and what your role is there.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm Chief Exec at Office for Nuclear Regulation. We essentially look after health, safety, security, safeguarding right across Great Britain's 37 nuclear sites. We advise government on policy around new nuclear, and we also work with vendors who might want to put new nuclear sites into the UK through advice and generic design assessment. So broadly, safety and security and the nuclear estate, we're the regulator.
So on that then, Adrian, do you have a typical day at work? What do you, when you wake up, what sort of things are you normally doing?
The thing I love about this job is there genuinely isn't a typical day. The thing that will be solid throughout every day, every month, every week will be that there are people involved, and there'll be opportunities and there'll be some challenges to resolve. But I genuinely love the fact that there's a variety. I might be doing things like this, for example, in supporting new generation of people coming into the sector, and maybe meeting with government, sometimes quite tricky negotiations about funding, about governance. Clearly, my prime responsibility is to lead ONR and as effective a way as I can so that my people love what they do, that they're all equipped and skilled to do what they do to the absolute best of their abilities, and to help modernise us and look to the future so we're a lot more inclusive and a bit more modern and technologically advanced in how we do things. So my job really here is to help everybody do their job to the best of their abilities.
So we'll go straight into a little bit about what's your background, how did you get to where you are now, where did you grow up, where did you go to school, just a little bit more about yourself.
Well, that's a ton of questions. So in no particular order, I was born in Falkirk. I moved from there quite quickly at the age of 6 months. So essentially I've moved about a lot of the west coast of Scotland, Ayrshire, Lanarkshire, Renfrewshire, everything with a shire. And really that was because my parents always wanted to do better for us. They weren't rich people at all. As you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not particularly posh. But they put everything into allowing me to indulge what became a passion of mine, which is show jumping. So not many folk know. I'm actually a horsey person. I'm still trying to get really good at, but horses I loved. So my kind of 12 to 17, 18 year was just obsessed with ponies. I recommend to any parents out there or protective parents who are thinking about buying a pony, don't do it. Don't do it. It's much more money than anybody ever tells you. But for me, it really allowed me to get confidence and to plan things and to understand accountability. You don't feed your horse, it dies. It's not like a Tamagotchi, it's a real thing. And also critical path. You know, trying to get to the finals at the Royal Highland Show required you to be at certain other shows to qualify, to get ready, to be fit, to have your horse in a good frame of mind. So I absolutely loved that, but it kind of wasn't real world. You know, it's very hard to make a living out of show jumping and eat. So I left there, and I'm not like many other chief execs, a lawyer or an accountant. I don't consider myself particularly academically bright, but I went off and I was a temporary PA. I worked for a few years across different organisations. I was a pretty good PA, I have to say, but what I loved about it is I was constantly listening and constantly watching. So whilst a lot of folk think that's irrelevant to my day job as a chief exec, it absolutely isn't, because the more you take out of every single job you have, no matter what the job title is, who pays you, what they think you're doing, do that, but be on the watch for every bit of learning you can get out. And really working across different organisations, many in the private sector, gave me a great insight at the age of 17, 18, 19, 20, into culture, into why people do stuff, into how things get done, into why things don't get done. But really, I kind of earned my spots there. I became an accidental trainer. That was another story. I was a verifier for City and Guilds. I did systems, I did consistency, I did proportionality, all very handy in my current job. And I went on to do things that work for the Big Lottery Fund, which was an amazing career boost for me over many years. A great organisation that taught me not only how to run large-scale operations, one of the biggest grant makers across Europe, but also working with community groups who had very, very little. So I think this sense of responsibility to others and a sense of looking after a community was very much born through, you know, those sort of jobs I had there. And then I thought, I'm going to be 40 and I'm coasting. I'll be really honest. I sat in a board meeting at the Big Lottery Fund as it was, and I just realised I wasn't as engaged as usually, and I made the decision that day that I was going
to
leave.
Was that to do with not being challenged enough in what you were doing? Or?
I think so. I had an amazing team with the best results anywhere. You know, we did really well. People who I'm still great friends with to this day who helped me in my career. I might have been their manager, but they actually all have made me who I am. And I just realised I wasn't as into it, which is, you know, wherever you hit that, you should be moving. I don't mean a bad day. I mean, just realising the lack of engagement. So I went off. I went to Hull City Council, a job I'd never done, a sector I'd never been in a place I'd never visited. And I went to live there, and I did that just as a baptism of fire. I'll give it a shot and see if I survive, which I did. And I've come back over now, Child Safeguard and Services and now ONR. So I'm a big believer that you do need to try different things to find your space in life, and you should get everything you can out of every one of them. You should do that too, right? You're always trying stuff?
Totally, yeah, yeah. And sort of not be frightened of change and moving on at the right time, perhaps.
Literally, what's the worst that can happen?
True. Okay, so Adrian, so how about now? Where are you now residing, and what does life look like for you now?
Yeah, I get asked where is home a lot, despite the accent. Home is actually Liverpool. I moved there from my last job, and I was really lucky that for the first time in a long time I could get a new job without physically relocating. So I live about 15 minutes from Crosby Beach, which I love because for me water and being around that is just a nice way to relax and calm down. Other people do sport. I love being on the water. And my main place of work is in theory in Bootle, our main office for ONR there. We also have Cheltenham, and we have a great team in Cheltenham and also in London. But, you know, that's very much home for me. My mum is still in East Kilbride. I'm an only child, so I see her as often as I can. I don't have sisters and brothers. I don't have children. I'm not married, so I appreciate very free in how I choose to spend my time with my friends. But, yeah, home for me is where I hang my hat. Wherever I will be, I will make it comfortable for myself the best way I know how. And, again, I think I had a real fear of that when I left to work in Hull. I was afraid of it, and I'd spent many, many years travelling up and down to London, living out of a suitcase, or travelling to my regional offices, living out of a suitcase. I was always afraid of relocating. And now I look back and I think, you're an idiot, woman. What's the worst thing? You know, go on, give it a try. If you don't like it, you can always go home. So now I'm right up for, I will take whatever comes next. But for now, Liverpool, all the way.
And ONR for now, you're stuck.
I love ONR. I mean, I generally, you know, what's not to love? It's exciting. It's super bright people. There's a lot of changes going on for the better, I most certainly would say. It's an exciting environment. It's quite challenging in many levels as well. But, you know, I always think if I love my team, the job's very, very much easier. And ONR offered me a 3-year contract 3.5 years ago. And they offered me another 3 years, which I signed on to from January this year. So, again, I'm fortunate to be able to be there a little bit longer to see things through, and love it.
Does that role take you internationally as well, or is it mainly UK-based?
It does take me internationally, and this is what I mean about try stuff, because you don't really know where it'll be. Here was the worry in taking this job, because pretty much everybody told me not to take it. Adrienne, what are you thinking? A regulator, not even a nuclear, a regulator. It's going to be so dull, it's going to be so boring, you're going to be tied to the desk. That actually, I didn't see it like that, but I didn't know until I landed. And I've done much more out and about, much more stakeholder engagement than I imagined, including internationally. So again, I think in terms of the ONR brand, we really do want to play a big part, not just at home, but we genuinely think we're one of the best regulators in the world, and I think we have good cause to do that. So how do you say that if you don't benchmark yourself to other organisations, to other countries? How do you say that if you're not in the best and the brightest in other domains? So, you know, I work not just internationally in nuclear, but across other kind of regulators and sectors in the UK. And we've been doing more of that the last few years. But, you know, who thought in this job I would be, you know, providing, I hope, a modicum of inspiration and a little bit of laughter, I'm sure, to, you know, 600, 700 people in Abu Dhabi. At the WIN conference in 2016 in my first year, or to the combined YGN conference at Youth Generation Network and Women in Nuclear Global Conference in Bariloche in Argentina. I didn't know where Bariloche was. Where is this? It's very far away. I can tell you. 33 hours door to door, I can tell you.
Wow.
But to get and do that and to just help other folks, maybe not be as afraid of some of the change I was at that year, is brilliant.
So you've mentioned Women in Nuclear there. Do you want to go into a bit more about what you do for that network?
I nearly didn't get involved in WIN on two fronts. They were the first of any stakeholder to write to me when my appointment to ONR was announced. I wasn't even in the door. And Miranda Kirschel, who was president at the time, asked me if I would come and speak at their conference. And it was literally day nine. It would have been day nine of my new job. So my new comms team, who hadn't really met yet, asked for advice. And they went, oh, don't do that. You know, you don't want to be making a speech in your second week. What did I think? What's the worst that can happen? You know, I mean, you get this. I'll give it a shot, you know. And it was the best move I ever made. So selfishly, that network connected me to state. Because the nuclear industry is quite complex to get a hold of, all the supply chain, the different kinds of licensees, the different kinds of sites. So here I am in one place in my second week with a bunch of folks saying, here's my card. So I'll be forever grateful to that network for embracing me, frankly, as a non-nuclear person, into it. I just sort of, later in the year, they wrote to me to ask me if I would become patron. Now, I thought it was a joke. I put that email in the B for bin pile because I thought it was one of them having a giggle with me.
This wasn't from Miranda, was it?
This was what Jack and Miranda were around then, and the Nuclear Institute was involved. And the way it happened, there was slightly sort of out of sequence correspondence came to me, which was why I was surprised. And then about 10 days later, I had this very courteous follow-up saying, you know, we know you usually deal with things within about, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours, Adrian, we're conscious you haven't got back to us. And then I had that oh moment where I realised it was a real thing. So I'll be really honest, I wasn't entirely sure I wanted to be a face of women in nuclear because, frankly, I was a bit afraid of being seen as some kind of, you know, raging feminist or just promoting women's issues. Mm-hmm. And my background and my whole career, you know, I spoke about lottery roles earlier, you know, working at a city council, you can imagine, especially quite an impoverished one like Hull. The whole thing for me is about inclusion. What I'm really, really, really passionate about is getting the best out of everybody. And therefore, I worried that this was going to kind of run a bit counter to who I am. But when I looked around the sector and realised at that time, less than 20% of it's women, it's a bit higgledy-piggledy in terms of where they are in structures as well. And actually, the real dearth of young women wanting to come into the sector, seeing it as attractive, I had one of those moments where I thought, well, okay, Adrienne, if you don't do it, who do you think will? So I got involved because I thought the job needed done. And clearly, that was just about 3 years ago, my term. They asked me to do that for a couple of years and I extended for another one. But essentially for when, as patron, my job is really simple. It's just to look the seniors in the eye, because obviously with my job, I get a lot of access through whatever I'm doing and ask them if they're really doing enough and to hold sometimes, you know, conversations that might offer some suggestions. But it's also about getting involved in the YGN and other things and just trying to mainstream an inclusive approach into everything that we do. And I think when is it times misunderstood as some kind of, you know, women's network for women and it's only, you know, we want something that we don't think anybody else should get, which is complete rubbish. Yeah. What we want are workplaces and a sector that everybody gets a really good working environment. And frankly, I think, you know, as I look around my organisation, I probably have more young fathers who will take paternity leave than I do women wanting to take long, long maternity leave. So for me, trying to get a place that works for everybody in a future generation is why, and for me, win is part of that. So that's what I got stuck into.
So that's actually a perfect segue onto the question that was asked by our chair, Ruth. She asked, how should we be looking at gender diversity in 2019 and what does gender diversity mean today when the definition of gender is becoming more and more fluid?
I think it's a great question, very typically by Ruth, a very intelligent and insightful question. Again, I stand back from it. I think people are many, many things. One of those things happens to be gender. But, you know, if I ask you to describe yourself in, you know, 50 words, there'll be a, you know, I wouldn't know, I mean, Adam, I've seen you in action, I think you're fabulous, but I don't really know you. You would describe yourself in ways that would give me a richness of a picture that I could really understand you more. And I think, therefore, my agenda, and I think it should be any leader's agenda about really trying to be inclusive, is about trying to get to know the folk that at least they work with on a day-to-day basis. I'm not pretending I know all 600 odd of my staff in ONR or every member of the huge WIN network. But the ones that I'm dealing with day to day, I try and know well. And for me, I disagree with the phrase that it's about treating people the way you want to be treated. I think we thought that for a long, long time. But for me, it's about understanding how to get the best out of every individual. And certainly if you're running any kind of business, surely that must be the thing we want. So I think to Ruth's question about, you know, what does gender diversity mean? I don't think it's any different from other kinds of diversity and inclusion where you say, Adam, How do I get the best out of you? What do I need to know about you? What's important to you? What do you never want me to do because it will really, really hack you off? What could I do that would put a smile on your face for a week? How do I know if you are genuinely thriving or under stress? And I think to have those kind of conversations with people really is how you get inclusivity. That's tough because you have 12 people you manage. All 12 of them are different, but that has to be the job of a leader, to try and be true to yourself but flexible to other people to get the best out of them.
So you mentioned just before about you're originally a PA and you kept your ears open and that's how you learned and that's how you kind of progressed. I kind of want to pull on that strand a little bit. What advice, particularly for young people who are kind of in roles where they might think, I'm stuck here, for example, a PA. But what advice would you give to them and how do you think they can kind of break that mould and use the core skills they've got to progress?
So I have a saying with pretty much all the people that I mentor, no matter what the level, and it's this: never leave your career in the hands of your employer. It's very simple for me. If you are entirely beholden even to a great employer, then you kind of put yourself in a hostage situation. If it is not provided for you, then it's not going to come. Most of my jobs didn't really invest in me because I was just the temp. So a lot of my early days, my first project management qualification, I did off my own back with my own cash at night. I did my training diploma part-time on weekends and at night. So, I think there's a bit where you can have a great employer, but don't take that as the be-all and end-all. Give back to your employer where they're good to you, but you should always retain control of your career. And, I think advice-wise, I guess it's a bit attitudinal, primarily. I was raised by a father who, constantly said to me, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I was a lot shyer. This person that you see now has had many years of being beaten out of shyness and, been the person that held myself back, not other people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very easy to be seduced by a narrative that, somebody else is stopping us do something. I do it myself sometimes and I catch myself and get really annoyed. So no matter what your role, if you wish to be something different, take accountability for it. You're going to have to work for it. You're going to have to make choices. We can't all have everything we want in life. I fully, fully admit that. But I think if something is important enough to you, then physicality aside, because the one thing you can't do is get taller, pretty much everything else you can work on. And I think that the other big piece of feedback, which some people find, I think, particularly challenging, is to be a feedback junkie. To constantly be asking for feedback, not just from the folk, because every now and again we need somebody to see you doing a good job. We want that, because sometimes it's hard. Mm-hmm. But I do observe a differential between those people who are more prepared to seek out views that they might not agree with, but that are going to give them more harsh feedback sometimes. Mm-hmm. So really getting balanced feedback on a regular basis and getting folk who are going to challenge you. But the number one thing, create opportunities for yourself. I'll give you an example. Many moons ago, several jobs ago, I had an aspiring head of programme ask if she could shadow me. And Lynn wasn't senior in the ranks, but she was super, super bright and very engaging. And I said, well, what kind of thing are you thinking of? And she told me, and I said, well, I tell you what, I've got a three-day slot where I'm in the Glasgow office. Why don't you come? You can just stay at my house. We'll do this. I'll give you as much access. You can come to every single thing. You can ask me 1,800 questions, whatever it is, but it's 3 days and bust. What I want you to do is a report on what you've learned and also, for me, what I should learn. And she did an amazing job, a super report. I learned more than she did, I think, I have to say, having somebody watch me for 3 days. But about a month later, somebody in a similar position to her, really in quite an unhelpful, in my way, in my view, said to me, how come she got that? And I said, she asked. Yeah. He seemed to think there's some conspiracy with a stitch up that this woman got. And you won't get opportunities to be asked. Don't wait, because they're not all advertised. I don't mean jobs per se. But if you want to shadow somebody, you want to have a go, you want to find out how something works, ask. Most people will actually say yes, but most people don't ask. Don't put your career in the hands of your employer. Hold it yourself, hold it tightly, hold it firmly, and make sure that you sweat every opportunity you get.
We're also interested to hear, Adrian, about what you think of Cumbria. Clearly, you're not a native Cumbrian. It's, between Scotland and Bootle, it's sort of somewhere in between. But your views on the county as a place, as a, the nuclear sector, what it means to county, maybe a bit about how you see it developing in the future as well.
Well, I tell you, I have an affinity with Cumbria. As I said earlier, I love being on the water. And a couple of weeks ago, I was up in Windermere and then out in Coniston having a bit of a kayak about. So I do love it up here. And I also have an affinity because when I joined ONR, the first site I went to, I was about 6 weeks into my role and just about considered safe enough to go out, albeit with supervision. I was out with the Deputy Chief Inspector at the time. And Sellafield was the first site that I actually came to. And as somebody who was new to the sector, it was both thought-provoking and really pretty, very sobering about what goes on in that mile and a half square foot and the number of people working on, you know, really challenging engineering issues, more often than not as a good team. And we've seen Sellafield take leaps and bounds in its decommissioning and its hazard reduction, which I'm really proud of. But I think the, you know, the sense of the energy in this area, clearly the changes in GD aspirations, I know hit a lot of people on a personal level very hard. All I can say is that, you know, for Cumbria to have the kind of environment that you're in, the passion of people who are here for complex engineering issues and really looking for careers. People want to stay in Cumbria, which is unlike some other rural areas. And a sector that really wants to get going. You know, I think, you know, I have these conversations with Ivan and others at the board. ONR's role is simply to regulate in the most enabling and appropriate way possible. But as a human being, it would be tough not to like Cumbria. I'd like it to have less rain, I'll be really honest. I can get that stuff if I go home. Yeah. You know, but clearly that's why it's so green. But it's always a pleasure to drive over and, you know, hit that sign saying welcome. And, you know, I'm here. The reason we squeezed this interview with you guys in is because I've just been with my whole board and some of my senior team to have another trip around Sellafield. I think that's three times in about 3.5 years. So we understand the significance here, not just of Sellafield, but of the other organisations, NNL and others, who are really trying to break boundaries. And I wish you all the best with that.
So in a post-Brexit world then, Adrienne, what will it mean to leave Euratom and how will that affect UK's regulation of nuclear?
Well, I have been asked this question so often in the last 18 months or so. You know, as you'll know from the ONR team, we're very focused, we are very good at project management and so on. And when we first saw the spectre of leaving Euratom, we worked with Bayes in particular to set up a distinct project in the organisation. It happens to be our Deputy Chief Inspector who looks after Sellafield, Mina Golsham, is leading this project. And, you know, from that point, we have sought to make sure that ONR does not create any difficulties for any businesses of any kind. So we're already running what was phase one. We didn't leave Brexit, as most of your listeners will have noticed, but we've stood up phase one of the project as if we had. So we're running parallel to Euratom, and essentially that's giving us some really, really good time to quality control things, or quality assure to be accurate, to make sure the new system, the new team, everything that we set up to get going is actually, believe it or not, up and running alongside Euratom. What we're looking at now potentially is phase two of the project, which is achieving Euratom equivalence. And put simply, that means developing our team, getting them even more experience and agreeing with government the scope of all of the work that they want us to do by December 2020. So we're doing that actually over the next couple of months. I have great faith in this project, and I generally believe this is not going to create problems for anybody, certainly not in Cumbria, but anybody in the nuclear chain. We've had independent assurance on this. As you can imagine, it's a crucially important project to get right. And I think out of the 150-odd Brexit-related projects in the government portfolio, the SSEC, as we call it, is the only green one. So this is a project that is ready to go. I'm incredibly grateful to the team. It's been an amazing job they've done. But we've really, really been at our best on this. Very clear focus, absolutely no distractions, diversions, on with it. Because we know, at some point, we could be asked to stand up. And actually, if we do a Brexit 31st of October, as is the current political intent, then we will stand up phase one for real, and we're good to go on that.
So with that, where do you see the link on in new nuclear, obviously, with NuGen and Merseyside not happening? How do you see that kind of developing, if at all?
First thing I would say is, on a personal level, it's really hard to see so many people lose jobs when they went in for something that was bright and energising and future focused. You know, you would have to have a heart of stone not to feel for that. And potentially, whether that causes reputational damage to nuclear as a sector that can attract people from other sectors, I think we need to see. you know, more from my job's perspective, I have a really, really simple task when it comes to new build, which is to never be on anybody else's critical path as a problem. So all we can do is work with what is put in front of us. I frankly would like us to be even busier. Half of my staff will probably murder me saying that out loud, but you know, we're good at what we do. We have we've revised our generic design assessment processes. We're ready to rock with those. We are constantly talking with supply chain and others who want to know what it's like to work in nuclear, nuclear AMRC, for example. You know, we're talking to them about fit for nuclear qualifications. So we're a very, very open and plain speaking regulator. It is my nightmare that we would ever get ourselves in a position where we didn't have the capability and capacity to support whatever it is that is required of us at that time, whether it's new build, decommissioning, operating reactors, defence, security. Doesn't matter what it is. So, you know, my day job is to be ready for whatever comes. It's definitely difficult with the level of uncertainty. I'm sure it is for you, right across the board and the shadow board. And we're all trying to deal with that the best we can. But we have to make assumptions and we have to make estimates based on what we think is coming. So, you know, whatever the government's policy intent is on nuclear, we stand ready to support it.
So I've heard you've got a thing about comfort zones, Adrienne. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
So your comfort zone is not your friend. I've been doing some lectures across various... If lecture sounds very fancy, doesn't it? I've been having some conversations, let's be clear. I've been mildly interesting. You know, entitled Your Comfort Zone is Not Your Friend. And it's back to the thing I said earlier about being afraid to try things or imagining that there are barriers that aren't. And it's been fascinating in this very scientific kind of, you know, sector that the psychological sciences, to me, are, you know, the physiological sciences are not seen with quite the same, you know, shall we say, profligacy as we see in, you know, engineering or chemistry or structural engineering, for example. So I've been showing people what happens in the brain when we get a bit comfortable. We've had a bit of a giggle about it because I think some people just don't believe it's a physical thing. They imagine comfort zone is some kind of just a psychological construct, but actually your brain does stuff. So we've been having a bit of fun with things about amygdala hijacks, which is essentially what you get whenever you get road rage. You know, this adrenaline rushes through you and you want to completely disproportionately batter somebody you've never met before for cutting in on you up the A6 or whatever it might be. And just that sense of, you know, either the fear and stopping you try things, but also the overreaction to what we perceive as threats. So, you know, I may receive feedback, which I personally find hard. I posture up, you know, I lean into you, I explain why you're wrong, and I go, you know, think you're a terrible person. Whereas actually what I should be doing is saying that's really helpful. So the comfort zone thing for me is just trying to get people to be mindful of when they are literally mentally sitting in this warm, seductive, you know, 14 and a half tall comfort zone, and actually not realising that that's the thing that's strangling them. It's not the risk that's holding them back, it's the comfort zone. So we've had a lot of fun, and we might do one up here, but we've had a lot of fun with folk kind of beginning to have this mantra, your comfort zone is not your friend. In fact, we should do a hashtag on that, really, shouldn't we? Just for a bit of a giggle and see who can tag it, because we've all got them. But if you want to be your biggest, best, boldest self, you have to be aware of it, and you have to be the one taking control and getting out your comfort zone. So we should chat about that offline. That'd be fun. I'd like to know what you two have done out of your comfort zone in the last month. That's the real teller, because you're obviously prepared to do podcasts, which isn't your day job. But what are you doing about this?
So I think that's a really important point about stepping out of your comfort zone. I suppose to answer your question, this podcast itself is kind of outside of my comfort zone. So my day job at Sellafield Limited is in the 1L support office. So it's nothing, anything to do like this. And obviously I used to work in corporate affairs. So that kind of did give me that external bit, but joining the shadow board and doing stuff like this, that does take me out of the comfort zone, but to a point where I think I can grow from that. And then obviously then as your comfort zone expands, you then got to keep making the steps. So no, I think that's, what about you, Adam?
I think for me, I'm run a very small company of only 3 or 4 people or so. Because of the size of that, I do get out and meet a lot of people, business leaders, but also by being part of a shadow board, which is stepping me out of my comfort zone and getting involved in things and schemes and running, you know, events and things that I wouldn't normally get to do, it's challenging me in a sort of multifaceted way, not just in my usual business development mind and my kind of craft, which is filmmaking.
Yeah, and I love that. Ivan spoke to me about the shadow board at first and kind of got me in a bit of mentor. I think it was a prize by accident for somebody early in the days. But, you know, I go back to the sense. If you're the kind of person that says, it's not my job and I'm really busy, that's okay. You can't expect to develop your full potential. And I love the fact that both of you, you don't look, I have to say, remarkably uncomfortable. So you're obviously rocking the comfort zone busting. But this sense of, you know, what's the worst that can happen? You end up having a chat with me. It's probably worse things. But to really keep going for it. So I take my hat off to you. I love it. I would never have done this at this stage of my career. So good on you both.
Exactly. And we're really enjoying it, actually. We're speaking to a number of people and it's just a really nice open conversation. And it's not even an interview. It's an informal chat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Done really nicely.
So I guess it's congratulations for winning the Northern Power Women Transformational Leader of the Year 2019. It'd be great to hear a bit more about what that, you know, how you got to that and sort of, yeah, what led to that award.
I still don't feel that that's a real thing. My mum definitely does. She's nabbed it. But really, I mean, this came about because the ONR team and the Women in Nuclear Cumbria team stitched me up. And essentially enrolled me in for an award that I didn't know anything about. And then the next thing I knew, it was a bit like the win thing to start with, where it happened, in my view, by accident. I got an email in asking for support and statement, and then I realised that something was happening. And it was a really proud moment for me to be kind of on stage. And when Cumbria had won the award for innovation, the one before, in fact, I wasn't even in the room when they called my name. I was standing outside, having a party with them, jumping up and down, shouting and woohooing. And somebody had to come out and say, they're waiting for you on stage. And I remember my face just went bright red. And I ran in heels, that's not easy. I ran in from the wrong side of the stage, which confused everybody onto the stage. And I shouted, woohoo, because I couldn't quite believe it. But, you know, the award represents a change in a leadership tone in ONR and on behalf of the sector. This, you know, I hold it, but I hold it lightly on behalf of the people I work with. And just seems to have survey results in ONR change, you know, dramatically over 3 years. We're not perfect, but leadership visibility, gone from, you know, bottom quartile to top decile, trust and confidence that we'll actually act on things, it has gone up markedly. I'm really proud of that. The external stakeholder results for ONR are really, you know, in the 80 and 90% of support. So we're very fortunate there. And I think just the notion of diversifying the team, as I said earlier, it's not all about women, but we were very, very male-orientated in ONR, and we see a much more diverse, and therefore a much, frankly, better, stronger and more fun team to work with. I think the other thing that came across there was, again, a real team effort to get inclusion issues onto the face of the nuclear sector deal. I'll be interested to see how government actually holds industry to account on that and understands its importance, but that is highly unusual and I think shows the impact that WIN and other groups have had on helping government understand that inclusion and diversity isn't some kind of side dish. It is a main meal, and if you tackle that well, you really make a difference to business.
So thanks, Adrian. It's been really interesting. That covered some great points. People might see regulators and the ONR as the big bad wolf in all this, but you certainly haven't come across as one. So you're obviously inspiring people and you're doing great work across the many things that you do. So thank you for your time today.
You're very welcome. There's no big bad wolves in ONR. We generally are all humans and we all want the best actually for the public. That's why we work here. So can't wait. I'll look forward to your next podcast.
Thank you.